to this EBM podcast focusing on long COVID. I'm Alison Twycross and I'm Editor-in-Chief of Evidence-Based Nursing. I'm also living with long COVID. I'm a long COVID advocate and chair of the recently launched charity supporting Healthcare Heroes UK. Michaela, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Michaela Barnard. I'm a nurse. I'm a nurse academic in the children and young people's field of nursing. And I'm also living with long COVID. And I'm also a trustee of Supporting Healthcare Heroes. When I was severely ill in hospital with COVID, lots of healthcare workers looked after me and actually saved my life. And I was able to come home to my family at the end of that. So I'm really passionate about the work, you know, the situation where healthcare workers have caught long COVID through looking after people like me.
Thank you, Michaela. So during this podcast, we're going to be reflecting on the themes that emerged from EBN content on long COVID. When we went through this content a couple of weeks ago, it became clear that since the start of the pandemic, there's been a lack of available support in several areas. We've got non-evidence-based infection control guidelines, which means healthcare workers and others have had inappropriate PPE, an increased risk of getting COVID infections compared to other professional groups. Those of us with long COVID have had difficulty accessing appropriate medical care, and that applies even to healthcare workers with long COVID who understand how the system works. And there's also a lack of support for people returning to work. And I know that I've heard lots of horror stories about how little support people in the health service are getting when they want to return to work, which seems scandalous, given that they caught COVID caring for us when we needed them to. So what we're going to do during this podcast is reflect on those three areas as people living with long COVID and as nurse academics as well. So we're going to start with non-evidence-based infection prevention and control guidelines. And this is one of the things that perplexes me most about the way the UK has handled COVID in the UK. Our infection control guidelines remain non-evidence-based. And there's a refusal to acknowledge that COVID is airborne and that this means healthcare workers need appropriate PPE, i.e. more than a surgical mask. Indeed, as someone in the clinically extremely vulnerable group and as editor-in-chief of EBN, I don't understand the NHS's continuing refusal to implement masks in healthcare settings, despite the obvious advantages of this. Michaela, I wondered what your thoughts were on this.
I feel like there's kind of been a memory lapse. It's almost like a purposeful reluctance to move back into previous situations that we've been into, because society wants to move on from COVID, doesn't it? But we can't move on from COVID because it's still there, it's still prevalent. And, you know, our healthcare workers are still vulnerable, and people like you and I who are in that clinically extremely vulnerable category are still vulnerable. And people like you and I with long COVID, every time we catch COVID again, then, you know, our long COVID symptoms worsen. And, you know, I've recently had an experience of that. But also, probably you and I spend some time in hospital waiting rooms, in outpatients, in different departments. And so I'm constantly getting a refresh of what's going on now with PPE. What are people wearing? How are they protecting? How are these healthcare workers being guided to protect themselves? What equipment have they got? And my constant answer at the moment is nothing. Nobody I meet in kind of an outpatient setting is wearing any kind of protective equipment. And I'm sat there in the waiting room, you know, with my mask on and, you know, trying to protect myself in the best way possible. But I've also got this second mind about, you know, I want the healthcare workers to be protected. I see a hospital setting or a clinic setting as being an extra layer of vulnerability for me, because I think this is where sick people go. This is where COVID infections exist in hospital. That's how I got my very first COVID infection. And so I feel exasperated for the people that are trying to care for me. And I feel frustrated for myself as someone with long COVID who's very desperate not to get it again. I don't know if that resonates with you.
Oh, it does for sure. I sat in a waiting room last week waiting for a minor procedure, and me and David, my partner, were the only ones wearing masks.
Yeah.
And we sat there for a long time, and we're both fairly vulnerable. And, well, I'm very vulnerable and David's fairly vulnerable. And it's just crazy.
Yeah.
I then had a nice surprise when the doctor came to get me, in that he was wearing an FFP3 mask, which, because he said it was for personal reasons. He persuaded the nurse to wear a surgical mask, which I thought was better than nothing. And I was able to keep my mask on.
Yeah.
But I was chatting to the nurse as she prepared me for the minor procedure. And she said, asked me how many times I'd had COVID. And I told her. And then she said, oh, well, I've had it 4 or 5 times. You know, that's what happens now, isn't it? And that really made me think and emphasise the fact, a bit like what you said, that healthcare professionals are going along with the ideology of COVID being over, but they're putting themselves at risk. It's so, so scary for me. And you, I guess, as yeah, trustees of Supporting Healthcare Heroes as well. It's scary. The RCN and the BMA did write to the government last year asking for mask mandates in healthcare, but I don't think they've ever had a reply. And the Royal College of Emergency Medicine published a report last week, which I haven't read in full yet, but was an audit of all the areas where infection control wasn't completely adequate at the moment. So that's an important read on my to-do list. And for people who'd like to know more about the lack of evidence in our current infection control guidelines, Dr. Yvonne Curin wrote an editorial that's free to access on the evidence-based nursing website. And I think it was published in the October 2023 edition, but I might be wrong. So read that and find out more. The next issue I wanted to discuss as a theme that came out of blogs and editorials for evidence-based nursing was the difficulty in accessing healthcare and appropriate healthcare that you need. Long COVID has been a new illness. We both got it in the first year. I got it in March. You got it in December, I think it was. And I think we've commented before that being chronically ill is almost a full-time job in itself, chasing up outpatient appointments. It's in some ways interesting having a new illness, particularly as nowadays there's an expectation that all illnesses can be cured. And I think that makes it more difficult when there are no answers. The patient group as a whole has struggled to get access to the support we need. The Society of Occupational Medicine guidelines on returning to work, what works, that were published in August 2022, I think, have a list at the back of them in the appendix that lists all the tests that people should have. So the evidence is out there, but accessing those tests is incredibly difficult. Perhaps not surprising, given how long the NHS waiting lists are and how busy they are. And there are discussions on social media every now and then about referrals being turned down because they're for long COVID rather than something else. That's only anecdotal evidence, but there's enough anecdotal evidence to suggest there's a grain of truth in that. And I always feel slightly uncomfortable when I'm fighting to access care because, yeah, I've got long COVID. I've had to retire early. I'm very limited in what I can do, but I'm okay. And I know that the NHS is super busy. But I also have knowledge about where to turn to for help. So when I got a phone call from the respiratory consultant from my local long COVID clinic in March 21, I think it was, saying, oh, you've got type 2 diabetes, and just telling me to go on a low sugar diet. I was able to talk to a friend who was a diabetic nurse. I was able to contact my GP, and I went on a low carb diet and was prescribed metformin. But I wonder what would have happened if I'd just followed the initial advice and tried to manage it myself. It's crazy. I'm still waiting for referrals nearly 4 years down the line. Can you tell me a bit about your experience in this context?
Yeah, so before COVID arrived, I actually had a pre-existing long-term condition. I've got severe asthma, which is probably why I found myself severely ill in hospital with COVID. But when I came out of hospital and, you know, I was still, you know, I had another bout of pneumonia at that point. So it took me a few months to work out, am I okay now or am I not? And the answer to that was, I don't think I'm okay. And at that point, I don't know if you felt like that, like 2020, early 21, long COVID was being mentioned, but nobody, you know, this word long COVID was brand new. You know, we knew about COVID, but long COVID, that phrase was brand new. And I didn't really know a lot about it, nor did anybody else. And so by summer, when, you know, I'd been to my GP numerous times with very kind of probably what we now know as a typical glut of symptoms, you know, breathlessness, fatigue, like extreme fatigue, but I also had a whole set of symptoms that kind of weren't, you know, perhaps the average long COVID symptoms. And my GP said, we've just started a long COVID clinic in the region, I'll refer you there. And I had no idea what to expect, and I sent to a really backwater kind of health centre. When I got there, the long COVID clinic was one physio in a room. And he was a great guy. He did his best assessment, and he kind of got me kind of a bit more mobile and walking, but that was the end of the intervention. And then I was discharged. That was it. That was a long COVID clinic and wasn't really what I'd expected. And then I had these other symptoms, like I actually realized that I couldn't really hear very well. And so that's probably in part related to how critically ill I was with COVID, but, you know, I'd lost significant amount of my hearing. So that was a whole other kind of referral that wasn't necessarily related to long COVID. And I had hair loss and, you know, many other symptoms of which won't go into the many. And then I probably had about 2 years of like drifting on my own, is how I would describe it. Going to the GP here and there with new symptoms that had me worried, and trying to read research. But of course, everything that's coming out, it's not so that we can base any personal kind of interventions ourselves on what we think. You know, I read research and I think, gosh, that's really interesting and that holds promise. But I want to hear more profound, more studies, more. There's nothing that I can and start going to my GP necessarily and, you know, asking for interventions based on that piece of research. And then in April of last year, I had a third COVID infection, and it's always going to be pretty bad for me because of my asthma status. But what I realized is that long COVID can pull the rug right from under you, you know, in the blink of an eye, because I thought I knew what my long COVID was. And post that infection, I realized that long COVID was going, hold on, I've just given you a whole new load of stuff to deal with. And I found that incredibly difficult, to the point that I went to my GP in the summer and kind of, you know, had a good cry and said, you know, what do I do with this? And he said, well, let's send you back to the long COVID clinic. And I thought, is this still a physio in a room? And actually, the long COVID team I'm under now bears no resemblance to that earlier team. And they're really great. I'm seeing three different kind of teams within that. And they've also been great at referring me to other people that I might need referrals from, you know, some help with. And that's still a work in progress. But this kind of couple of years of drifting was a really difficult time. And now I feel like I'm in this place of kind of great uncertainty, really, where I'm still getting new symptoms. I never know what's around the corner. And I hate that. It's really, really difficult. And so, like, at my last appointment with the long COVID team, they're like, you need to go back to your GP because that set of symptoms is new and we need to rule out X, Y, and Z. You know, so it's this constant cycle of uncertainty and what do we do now? And I go to a particular GP. He's very good. He listens. He tries to problem solve with me. He'll tell me what he does know and what he doesn't know. And I really appreciate that kind of approach. He knows what I do for a living, so he'll kind of chat to me at my kind of level, which I also appreciate. So yeah, that's like, that was a lot, but that's kind of where I'm at with all that. And that is that I don't know what the future holds. I'm very uncertain about where I am right now. And sometimes it's a real fight to get some of the care that I think that I need. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And I can see that it's been a bit triggering and a bit upsetting. Yeah. So thank you. And I can understand that. It's made me think about my long COVID journey. And interestingly, I don't think I've ever been to my GP about my long COVID per se. I was thinking about this when I tried to fill in the long COVID SOS survey last week. I think I go for individual symptoms and then they do their thing, do tests, refer me on if needed. And I was never checked out after my two infections in September and December last year. It's interesting. And it's, I'm pleased that you've been referred back to your long COVID clinic, because my long COVID clinic, after a few initial tests, was just focused on rehab. It's run by an OT who's very good. An occupational therapist is very good. And we did some workshops about like fatigue and getting back to work. And there was another one. I was discharged and I don't think there's anywhere else to go. And we know that funding's not guaranteed either now that NHS England have pulled central funding. So it's kind of interesting. And I suspect your story and my story are fairly typical of what's been happening. And as you say, reinfections, avoid them like the plague.
Yeah. That's one of the scariest things, I think, isn't it? That, you know, it's there in the wings all the time. And you know, I'm doing everything I feel like I could possibly do, but I'm also working and I'm meeting lots of people out in society most days in the week, you know, and so it's limited what you can do, but I'm doing everything that I can.
It is a real dilemma.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's scary how easily I caught COVID, particularly in September when I was on holiday and only went to the beach. Yeah. And I have this dilemma about wanting to keep myself in a bubble, but also needing to see my friends and family. It is really tricky. And I just wish people would wear masks and that people would test for COVID and that they'd stay at home when they were infectious. Even members of my own family don't test.
Yeah.
And they roll their eyes when I long COVID and COVID itself.
I've had very similar experiences, but of course the government doesn't make it easy for people to be able to test now. If you're not vulnerable like we are, like I have access to test kits, but other people have to buy them. And if they have to buy them, that's a whole other threshold, isn't it, of willingness. And also, like yourself, friends and family, like, want this is, you know, that was 2020 and now we're 24. Like, COVID's part of life. You know, you've just got to get to grips with it. Well, that's not how it is for me, you know, and I want you to support me.
Yeah, I'm very lucky on the whole, but it is really tricky and a real dilemma. for us and for many other people. Anyway, let's move on and talk about the lack of support in place when people are trying to return to work. And I'm focusing particularly on healthcare workers, but want to draw on your experience of getting back to work in an academic setting.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the reasons I became a long COVID activist and then went on to set up Supporting Healthcare Heroes UK was how appalled I was by the lack of support for staff returning to work with long COVID in the NHS. And I may have said this before, but I'm going to say it again because it's one of my bugbears. It feels incredibly unjust that healthcare workers who cared for us when we needed them to, despite not having appropriate PPE, have now, to all intents and purposes, been abandoned by the government and the NHS. Lots of people weren't able to get back to work through a lack of support. Some people weren't able to get back to work because they weren't well enough. I had a message from someone on Facebook last week going, why doesn't the NHS allow job shares? I could do 12 hours a week, but all the jobs there are 24. And actually, I hadn't thought of it before, but that's a really sensible solution. And the lack of creativity in the NHS drives me crazy. Yeah. Although I do realise it's because things are so crazy that people don't have the time out to think outside the box. But we need to change that, given that we're in the middle. The COVID's not going to go away and that we have a massive workforce crisis. We can't be affording to lose these people. So let's hear how you got back to work, because I know you've said that your employer was really, really helpful.
Yeah. So first thing to say is that, you know, prior to being an academic, I worked for 20 years in clinical practice, mainly worked on a neonatal intensive care unit. If I had tried to go to back to work there, I wouldn't have coped for a minute. So let's just say that first of all. So me as a nurse in clinical practice would not have, I think I would have had some of those same experiences that you know, we're hearing about from healthcare workers. But I mean, my return to work was pretty, if when I reflect on it, I wasn't all that sensible. You know, I'd been really terribly ill in hospital and I didn't have enough recovery time, and then I felt probably pressure from myself, maybe a little bit pressure, gentle pressure from work, but to come back. And I went back far too early on a phase return that didn't last long enough and found myself in the breakneck speed of the semester. But because I already had this long-term condition, I was already registered. We have a department in the university I work with. It's a big university, and it's a disability support service, and it's for students and for staff. And so I very quickly asked to have a reassessment with them, and they were excellent. I literally, like, poured out all these symptoms, including my deafness, which was still very much in being assessed at that time. I didn't even know to what extent it was a problem, but I knew that I was struggling in my classes to hear. But my general issues were around actually trotting around the campus. So, you know, I could have a classroom 15-minute walk away in the morning, back to my office at lunchtime, in the classroom, another 5-10 minute walk away. I just could not do that in any shape or form, or else I'd be off sick the next day, you know, and that I knew that that wasn't working at all, and I was really struggling. So I very quickly had this reassessment, and they put some reasonable adjustments in place. I have got a supportive line manager, and she listens to kind of, she's obviously looked at my reasonable adjustments and made them work. I think what I struggled with for the first year or two with these reasonable adjustments was that I felt like I had to tell every Tom, Dick and Harry, which is really not what you want to do in terms of disclosure. Now my university has a better system about my name's on a timetable. It flags up my reasonable adjustment plan, and those people then go and look at the plan and see what I need in terms of rooms and so on. So that's improved, but I did feel like I was having to disclose a lot, which I didn't want to be. Well, it's your choice, isn't it, to disclose?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, yeah,
it is hard. You know, I feel like I've got so many kind of disabilities now. I've got, you know, chronic cough with my asthma. I've got long COVID breathlessness fatigue. I'm partially deaf. So, you know, there's like so many things. I don't want to have to list to everyone to meet. These are my needs. Can you meet them? I just want them to be met as best possible. But what I would say, so I'm back at work. I'm working full time. I've been back at work for a long time. I'm working full time. But the things that I said in your previous question to me is that I feel like my work life is still uncertain. So I am still struggling. Full-time work is too much for me. You know, so I'm still thinking about what is the right answer for me. There are things in my career that I'm not achieving that I thought I would, and that I'll probably never achieve. But I'd rather be alive. You know, I recovered from COVID, and that's the big bonus, when, you know, my family, myself didn't think I would. So I'll take that. But those things still, you know, they're something I'm grieving, really.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
I wake up in the night tormented sometimes by things I'm not going to do.
Yeah.
Now, and so I can completely understand that. Another academic I was speaking to the other week, a nurse academic, had to stop doing her PhD. Yeah. So even for those of us in academia,
yeah,
it's hard.
I can really understand that, because I finished my PhD the year before COVID hit. Now, if I hadn't finished it then, and I'd have been so close, I cannot imagine how I would have finished it. So I'm so grateful I got to kind of finish my PhD.
Yeah.
But equally, as an academic, you know, absolutely healthcare workers are at the priority front of my mind in this. But I think that someone like a nursing academic, like I am, and like you were, Alison, we're a big part of this NHS puzzle. If the people aren't there to be educating the next generation of nurses, you know, I still feel like I've got a lot to give in that arena. And I know I've got a lot of experience. So, you know, I've been in academia now for 15 years because I worked part practice, part academia for a while. You know, everybody's replaceable, but, you know, I still have a lot to offer. And so I think, you know, we want people still to be able to be in these jobs and be supported by their employers to do that. But I have to say also, you know, you were talking before about the rigidity of NHS boundaries around working hours. Academia is well known for not being great for part-time working, in that, yes, you can go down to part-time hours, but does your workload reflect that? And the answer is usually no. And so that's my dilemma at the moment. Do I adjust my hours so that I'm more part-time? But the likelihood is my workload won't change that much. And so that's something I'm still thinking about, talking to my partner about, and what's the right thing? Because my life at the moment is I'm living to work, and I don't want that balance to be that way. And it's long COVID that's making it that way.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. And lots of clinical people are saying that.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have to live like that. This is on a slightly different topic, but there should be financial support for people who are only going back to work because they can't afford not to.
Yeah.
There should be support in place for people who caught long COVID at work. And all employers should be doing way more. You're saying your employer could do more, but they've done more than a lot of other employers have done. I'm not saying that to make you feel bad, but yeah. Let's get real.
I am hugely grateful. I know that I've worked at other universities, so this isn't the only university I've worked at. And I know that I am fortunate, because I know that in the employer that I have at the moment has been incredibly supportive. Should I need to go back to my disability support service with more needs, then they'll be addressed. And more reasonable adjustments will be supported and put into place. And we also have a staff disability network at work, and that, you know, peer support is incredibly powerful. Is that peer support out there in the NHS? Actually in the organisation, I'm not sure. People have to come out of the organisation to kind of charitable organisations to find that peer support, don't they?
Yeah, all employers should be looking after their staff so much better. But the NHS, since I got long COVID and since I started the advocacy work, I've learned so much about how badly the NHS deals with disability among its staff and how bad or how ineffective the support is. And that's been quite an eye-opener as someone who used to be a manager in a university. We've got to get better. We've got to get better. It's interesting, there are some good examples, but it's very hard to get people to write about the good examples. So we need to say this. You've got a good example. Uh-huh. There are some good examples in the NHS. There's a wonderful nurse who lives in the Northeast who has almost created herself a job. I'm very proud of her. And she was a community nurse and struggling in the community. And she has created a job and now has full-time funding for it. She was going to have to apply for the job, obviously, but that's one example. But she had to push. And there are other examples of people who've maybe stopped working clinical shifts and are doing education roles. But then other people find teaching really hard work. And long COVID is so individual,
yeah,
that there's not one role fits all. I should add, if there are any managers out there who are wondering how best to support your staff with long COVID, the Royal College of Nursing has a web page with lots of information. And the Society of Occupational Medicine published a revised guide for managers on supporting staff with long COVID the other week. So have a look on the relevant websites and you'll be able to download those or access them for free. Michaela, thank you for joining me to discuss long COVID in this podcast. And thank you for sharing your story. It's really appreciated. And I'm sure it will ring true with many other people out there. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Please look out for other episodes of the EBM podcast on whatever platform you normally get your podcasts on. Thanks for listening.